On the surface, the whole book is about showing that the existence of these serpent gods, their manipulation of humanity, and their interbreeding with humanity is absolutely encoded in the very language. And because they don't want to be seen, they're terrified of being, of humanity understanding what's going on. So when I'm going through this, please don't, look at it and say, oh my God, we're in an impossible position. These guys are terrified of being exposed. And what they've done is they've put it in code. So the eagle, for instance, when you follow the entomology, it's a fascinating book, it's real challenging, really, because there's so many words and stuff. When you read it, as I've been doing it over the last few days, the eagle, when you follow it back, was a symbol of these Egyptian gods. That's why you have the American eagle, that's why you have the Iraqi eagle, that's why you have the Nazi eagle, and all the rest of it. That's why it's so frivolous. The goat, the goatfish, the horned goat, that's used in Satanism and all that stuff. Well, that's also code for the reptilians. They use these different codes. The ram's another one. The hawk figure. All these different things. The flying gods. And the most interesting thing is the number of words that relate to these serpent gods that relate to naval or marine symbology. They talked about coming in the heavenly boats. And when you follow the group of the words of that, what you find is the ancients talked about the sea on earth, the ocean, but they symbolized the sky as the upper ocean. So they used all these different marine terms, like heavenly boats and stuff, flying boats, to describe the angels. Again, take angel back, you go back to the serpent gods. And it's interesting, even today, we talk about space ships. And it's fascinating to see how it's encoded in the language. Now, one of the key things is the interbreeding, for reasons I'll come to. And all across ancient society, this is an example from the Bible, you see this recurring theme of the interbreeding between a non-human race, which overwhelmingly is symbolized as reptilian or the serpent with humans. And again, sometimes you have to go back through words to find out that it is actually symbolizing the serpent, because they appear to be non-serpent lizards who take on forms. Like, for instance, the human angel here and all that stuff. But when you take it back and try and actually word is back to serpent gods. So this is the one that was said in Genesis. There were giants in the earth in those days, and also after that, where the sons of God, translated properly, sons of the gods, came in unto the daughters of men, and they bare children with them, the same became mighty men which were of old men of renown. Now when you go across the ancient world, you find this constantly recurring theme of interbreeding between the gods and humans to create a hybrid bloodline, which will be very significant when we go on into present day. So these reptilians, these serpent gods, as I'll call them, they operate just outside the visible light. Now what they can do is come into it, but it can't stay for very long, because there's a vibrational incompatibility. And they have to go out. They can't stay for long, they can stay for a certain time. One of the ways they stay for longer is by drinking human blood, which carries the human mammalian code, vibrational code. So this starts to answer the question, why, wherever I go, in researching these hybrid bloodlines that are behind the God of the Illuminati and these serpent gods, in history or what we call modern day, it always leads to satanic ritual, human sacrifice, and blood drinking. What goes on? This is what goes on. It helps them stay here for longer. When they're not here, they feed off human emotional energy, low vibrational emotional energy, which actually vibrates to the base core energy of, yes, fear. So they set up society in this visible light world to create and to generate as much these laboratories like this, you've got a scientist, and he can't operate in this tank because it's too dangerous. So what he does, he stands outside the tank, puts the gloves on, and he can work inside. I've just described how this reptilian connection works to the Illuminati and the bloodlines. What the bloodlines are a hybrid genetic bloodline core, which, because of its hybrid nature, vibrates with greater sympathy to the reptilian vibration than does the rest of the general population, although there's a tremendous reptilian genetics in all of us, as we'll come to. So what these reptilian guys do, just outside of visible light, is they manipulate this reality through these hybrid bloodlines, which are conduits to allow them to experience and manipulate this reality as I've come to. And again, you know, wherever you go around the world, this guy's book, with his word derivatives of all these different ancient cultures, he comes up with exactly the same stuff. The fall of man, as it's called, you see that in the Bible, the Garden of Eden and all that stuff. The fall of man is associated all over with the serpent, the end of the golden age, the subordination of humans is associated with the serpent. And of course, in the Bible, Garden of Eden, which is in the Old Testament, and Genesis and all that stuff, it's just a rewrite of much older stuff going to Sumer and that area of the world in Mesopotamia, saying the same thing. And you know, when I go to Christian radio stations sometimes, and they bring the reptilian thing up, and I say to them, well, do you think that the the Garden of Eden story can be found in cultures all over the world, not just the Bible, very recurring story. I say, do you think that the serpent in the Garden of Eden was really a snake? Or do you think it could be symbolic of something else? In fact, the Hebrew word for serpent in the Garden of Eden means a two-legged standing up like a humanoid serpent. And it's all symbolic. And what happened with the arrival of this group was what I call the schism. I know how they did it now. I've got a few more dots to connect, and I want to bring it out as one unit, but I know how they did it. They created energetic catastrophe in this reality. And of course, when you create energetic catastrophe, that is decoded into physical catastrophe. And that's why, again, right across the world, the serpent gods are associated with what became known as the Great Flood, the Great Cataclysm, that devastated the earth. But it did something else. This energetic catastrophe, like I said, nobody did it, also fragmented human unity, human harmony. So when you talk, you see these ancient accounts of people living for vast ages in this idyllic bloody world where we communicate with animals and stuff. People think that's just fantasy, because we've been so given a sense of limitation that I can't, and it's not possible. We can't see that could happen. It did, but not after this schism. Now everything changed. We were in a situation where, first of all, we were decoding much wider frequencies of this virtual reality, much beyond visible light, and we held that connection. We were in this world, but not of it. And then along came the intervention, which created incredible energetic disharmony, and therefore that played out in the decoding world as catastrophe and division, and suddenly the world was a very different place. And the idea is to put humanity into a prison and feed off it. And the more control they have, the more they can feed off it and trigger that energy of will. It's one of the reasons for the microchip, one of the reasons. So the picture on the that side is a painting by Craig Lucro, the Zulu shaman, official historian of the Zulu nation. Magnificent man, right there in the lakes. Incredible. And he drew that, painted that, from ancient and modern accounts of people who have seen these entities. And this is Neil Hague's symbolic picture of these hybrids. And these hybrids became the royal bloodlines. This divine right to rule, the divine right, God's right gives me the right to rule. No, no. Serpent God. I am genetically connected to the serpent God. That's what they were saying. Therefore, I have the right to rule. That's what royalty is. Again, follow it back. Serpent, royalty, rule, all derivatives of the same. And the DNA is symbolized snakes, because they brought about genetic change, and in the general population of massive change in this hybrid, which now represent them as the Illuminati and as the royals of the past and all the rest of it. And they see, because they understand reality to a larger extent, they fully understand it, they don't see DNA as DNA, they see it as a computer code. And because everything in the end is a vibration, so then it's a vibration of code. So, like I said, when they created the hybrid's bloodline, they were creating one which vibrated in sympathy to them, and therefore they could possess, take over the mental, the faculties of that, of those bloodlines, far more powerfully than the general population. And there was another thing, absolutely crucial to understanding this world. They removed genetically the ability for these bloodlines to empathize. They have no ability, it could be if they became conscious, they'd get it that way, but through the body, the level they're working, they have no empathy with the consequences for others of their action. Which is why I've been saying to people for years, don't judge what these guys would do on the basis of what you would do, because it's not the same. We have empathy. We look at the consequences for others of our actions, and if they're unpleasant, that empathy says, I'm not doing that. If you don't have empathy, anything goes. 3,000 dead or 9/11, no emotional consequence for these people. They have no empathy. Genetically removed. So, what we're looking at is we, with invisible light, are decoding what is with invisible light. And on that level, we're decoding the human part of this hybrid bloodline. But if you could see just beyond that, you would see something very different to what we call human. And this process, this concept, theme of possession is as old as history, and often involves possession by a snake or a serpent. So, this is not symbolic, by the way, this is true. I know a number of people who sit, have seen him at another form. So when we, like I say, meet these people or see them on television, we'll be coding their five-sense level, their visible light level. So we see them as human. If you see beyond that, you will see something very different. And it's all the old pictures, by the way, of Charleston to do. So it's this vibrational sympathy between the hybrid and the possessing entity that allows these bloodlines to be possessed so powerfully. And what it means is something very simple. If they can manipulate these bloodlines into positions of power with invisible light, they're putting themselves in those positions of power because they're calling the shots and controlling the game. I've met psychics around the world, a number of them, who've seen people, not always, by the way, in positions of power, often, many times, but not always. And they've seen these reptilian entities, in an ethereal kind of way, moving around with big people, and they lock into these lower two chakra points, these vortex points. And I've heard that a number of times. So, what we have is the bloodlines, the vehicles, the hybrids, and they're possessed from just outside of visible light, and therefore in the shot, and they appear to be the ones in power. They're just shells. And the key group is this, the Rothschilds. The House of Rothschild. Get this out of the way for a start. They're not Jewish. And they couldn't give a shite about Jewish people. Let's get that right from the start. They are interested in control on behalf of them. And that's why all roads lead to the Rothschilds. It's nothing to do with Jewish people. It's to do with them and offshoots of them. And one of the supportive families of the Rothschilds that plays out in America and elsewhere is the Rothschilds. So it's not in the eye which I ask them to do. So this is the structure works. By the way, you'll see this bearded man in a number of pictures as we go through. That's Neil's symbol of the Illuminati, the hybrid bloodline Illuminati structure playing out in our physical life world. And the reason he's done that is these reptilians fight among each other like crazy. I mean, all the ancient accounts of the wars they have between each other. I mean, they're very strange. They asked me out for dinner. I said no. I'm going to be here tonight. So you've got the Illuminati, this hybrid, and they play out here. And this is the movie. This is the movie that we see. And it's this manipulating event to change society to fit that agenda. And this is the structure they created. You've got these entities just outside of visible light. They control the people in power. They control the politics, the finance, the media, the military, the religion, royalty, and then it comes down to the people who are controlled by this structure, and they don't even know that this structure exists. And, you know, it's not these people that fight wars. It's these silly sods that fight wars. These declare it. And because of the nature of the reptilian mentality, these all fight among each other as well, but there comes a point where heads are knocked together and it gets in the way, because they're all kind of desperate for power. It's part of the reptilian genetics, I'll come to it. But these declare war, and these fight them, and it's like George Bush. George Bush declared war on Iraq. And yet, if George Bush had been in Iraq when the first bullet was fired, he'd been under a bed in Houston when the second bomber went off, right? And yet, he is sending all these guys to die and suffer on behalf of not America, not freedom, the control system. So, what we're looking at with these powerful people, these powerful, they're shells. Themselves, that's why I say the people sitting around the table are at the player level of this. They're shells. But if they're good shells, like him, then they keep getting the jobs. I mean, he was Prime Minister of Britain for 10 years and declared war on anyone good, and now he's almost certainly going to be the first President of the European Union. The head of state, in effect, of the whole of Europe. Why? Because he's a shell. Some batches are better than others are. And it's kind of interesting, it just shows how irrelevant those in power are when this guy could be president and the whole thing plays out. Yeah. He was drinking Jack Daniels and watching the sport. Just had to sign here, George. He starts with a G. Someone sent me this. I'm not saying this is the reptilian eyes, it could be a play of life, but it's very symbolic of what people see. What's starting to happen to me, and it's kind of really strange. I got to that in the mid 90s, and I kept meeting people in the most incredibly synchronistic way who had this experience, they said, from every walk of life you can imagine. Some people from the Swiss banking industry who see people like the Rothschilds. That shift into very strange pools. And the common thing was they'd seen someone in a human form, just a regular human form, shifted into a reptilian form and abandoned. And those that hadn't seen the full body shift, one of the things that they said they saw very often, or more often than the full body shift, was the eye shift. And the eyes are the window on the soul, which I'll come to. Or the eyes are the window on deeper levels of reality. And this is what they see. They see this shift from the round pupil to the reptilian pupil. And interestingly, I've got a friend in England who operates in the scientific area, and he's got an associate who's been doing he's been doing a research project to develop iris scanning technology. He had no idea that this guy was a friend of mine. He probably never heard of it, I don't know. But what he said to my friend, he said, you know the strange thing? He said, I looked at 2,300 eyes, and about 4% were of reptilian type, because he looked at them very closely to a microscope, or a gun. And that, funnily enough, in my research and conclusions I come to, that is 4 or 5% is about the ratio of this hybrid bloodline to the human population. That's why they're terrified of exposure, because we've got the numbers. They might have the military, they might have the police, they might have the media, but they ain't got 7 billion, have they? And they're terrified. That's one of the reasons they want to call the population, by the way. This is, again, probably way on the line, but I like to, know people who have seen him shift, his eyes shift. And then, it's like, you know when you, it's like subliminals. You look at a subliminal advertisement, and you can't see the subliminal. And someone points it out, and then, when you look at that picture ever again, the subliminal is the first thing you see. Because you've taken it from the subconscious, from the below threshold, that's what subliminal means, into the conscious mind. When you start getting into this reptilian stuff, bizarre as it seems to be to start with, then suddenly you've brought it to the conscious mind and you go, bloody hell, ancient, modern, incredible. The reptilian serpent, symbolism, stories, word derivatives, all of it. For instance, the oldest form of worship is known to anthropologists, scientists, historians, is the worship of the serpent. It's been tracked back to 70,000 years ago in the Kalahari Desert, the sand people, the Bushmen. There is some hills, the Kalahari, the Salido Hills, I think they call them. And the Bushmen people say this was where the great serpent created humanity, basically, as we know it. 70,000 years ago. And wherever you go around the world, you find exactly the same. This was a guy called Reverend John Bathurst Dean. He wrote a book called Worship of the Serpent in 1933, and other people have done similar research, come to the same conclusions. What he found as he looked around the world was this. It appears then that no nations were so geographically remote or so religiously discordant that one and only one superstitious characteristic was common to all. That the most civilized and the most barbarous bowed down with the same devotion to the same engrossing entity. And that this entity either was or was represented by the same sacred serpent. It appears also that in most, if not all, the civilized countries where the serpent was worshipped, some fable or tradition which involved its history, directly or indirectly, alluded to the fall of man in paradise, in which the serpent was concerned. What follows then, but that the most ancient account respecting the cause and nature of this seduction must be the one from which all the rest are derived, which represents the victorious serpent, victorious over man in his state of innocence, and subduing his soul in a state of sin, into the most abject veneration and adoration of himself. Great summary of what you find around the world if you go back enough. And it's even bigger than that, like I was saying earlier, because when you follow the word derivatives, you find that things that don't appear at first to be connected to the serpent gods, actually, when you follow it back, it's all encoded in the language it was. For the same reason, a lot of the symbolism of the serpent gods, serpent race, is not directly serpentine, it's through other images which appear not human, and that's how they did the symbolism. But you still find lots of it, lots of it. These are figurines that were found in graves of the Ubaid people in what is now Iraq, Mesopotamia. The child and the serpentine figure, and there were many others. In India, they have the Nagas, the gods of Nagas, the Nagas people who were said to be able to take either human or reptilian form and move between the two. Again, Nagas is a word derivative that comes up in other words, in other languages, that relates to the meaning serpent. Again, the Nagas. The Celts worship the god Hugh, the serpent god, Hugh. So if you take that across, Hugh man, using that symbolism, means serpent man. Egypt, massive serpent god symbolism there. Right down to the very headdress, if you like, of the pharaohs, which is all based on the cobra. The cobra is a major symbol around the world of these serpent entities. The cobra there, the cobra. The headdress, the hood, and the underbelly here of the cobra. Of course, the classic in Far East, the dragon. The Chinese emperors used to claim the right to be emperor because of their genetic descendants from the serpent gods. And all around the world you see the same symbolism where people were claiming the right to rule, to be royal, because of their descendants. And one of the things these hybrids became known as in ancient writings were the demigods. Part god, part human. Created from earth and heaven. All these different symbols. Human, angelic. And again, these are serpent stories that are really endless. And when I first introduced this in 1998, in a book called The Big Secret, I went to speak in South Africa, and I got a call from this man, Frederick Bushwick. He was initiated into South African secret societies 60 years ago. He's heading for his 90s now. And the reason these secret societies existed, and still exist, was because when the European invasion came in, through the Dutch and through the British, in South Africa, they targeted the shaman because they wanted to take out of circulation knowledge of this. And that's one of the key reasons that the Christianity was imposed upon the colonial countries. It was to shut out the knowledge that had been passed through the shamanistic and other streams. And so to keep it alive, they created secret societies. And, you know, you never see that the DVD I think was played for about 6 hours called anyway, it's about I'm talking about the Richard. The Richard in the general, that's it. He describes the rituals he had to go through, prolific, before he could get access to this knowledge. So when he calls me, he said, "How do you know about the Chinahuri?" I said, "Well, that's Chinahuri, I don't know." At the serpent gods, the Chinahuri is the Zulu name. By the way, the very word Zulu means people from the stars. They were seeded by people from the stars, but that's what the word Zulu means. Anyway, the Chinahuri in Zulu translates as children of the serpent or children of the python. And he said, "How do you know about it?" And I explained it, I picked it up here anyway. And I went across and saw it, and I spent days with it. And he showed me this, the necklace of the mysteries. It's not really a necklace, it goes on his shoulders, it's bloody heavy. I could walk around with it, but it does, he's coming up to his 90s, incredible. Anyway, he puts this on his shoulders, and these different symbols he uses to tell the story of the African people, because he's the official storyteller of the Zulu nation. And these different symbols help him to tell that story. And by the way, there on that hand you see the all-seeing eye. Why? Because the serpent gods were known as dawn watchers. And so they were symbolized as the eye. This is why the human eye, all-seeing eye, and we see on the dollar bill, that's why it's there. Also on this hand is the constellation of Orion, because that's where they came from, this story goes. Anyway, this is the key point here. By the way, there's a flying saucer as well, a classic flying saucer on there. And this Necklace of the Mysteries is described in accounts 500 years old. Crato says it's at least 1,000 years old. So here we have the Earth woman, and here we have the non-human figure. And I said to him, well, if they're the Chitauri, why do they not look reptilian? And he said, because the serpents, the Chitauri, insisted that no one depict them as they really look, because they didn't want their existence known. This is why it's all code, like rams and hawks and eagles and stuff like this. Still to this day. Anyway, there you see the symbolic Chitauri with a willy in come and get me mode. How can I put it? He fits it to her. And I said, what's all that about? I could see by then, but I asked him. And he said, this is the union, the interbreeding between the Chitauri and humans. And interestingly, this was once gold, and someone stole it there, they couldn't find put a gold one in the place, so they used a copper one. But that takes us to North Africa from South Africa, and the heart story, one of the central stories of Egyptian myth, the golden penis of Osiris. Because all these different names, Osiris and Nimrod and Horus, they're all different names for basically the same entity, well, not even basically the same entity, just the same entities. Yahweh, another one. So there's the Earth woman. There's the Chitauri, which is what they did, because they were frightened of direct portrayal. They just portrayed them as absolutely clearly not human, and that's how they did it. But you can find, when you look, these little symbols. And one of the big ones is someone who is human to the waist, and then a snake from then down. This is the hybrid. Is another example of a hero. You've got the puppet torso is human, and then it becomes a snake. This is the hybrid bloodline being symbolized. And of course, it's so fantastic that most people wouldn't see it. And why would they see it unless you were put on the trail? And another thing is that the battle against the serpent is symbolized so often too. Here's another example of it. Fighting the serpent gods. The cobra, like I say, is used widely to symbolize this race. Even the word Messiah comes from Meta, which was the Nile crocodile, and you said the back of the Nile crocodile with the anointing oils of the pharaoh who was symbolized as the cobra. It goes on and on and on. Once this becomes conscious, you see it everywhere. This is a depiction of, in Revelation, of the devil. And the great dragon was cast out, that old serpent called the devil, and Satan, who deceived the whole world. He was cast into the earth, and his angels was cast out with him. And again, when you follow the word derivatives, my goodness me, angel means serpent god. Absolutely. Blatantly. This is also why God and his angels, the Lord and his angels, follow the Lord back, serpent God. Then you've got all these kind of stories that you get with fairy stories, which are what? So much truth in some of the fairy stories. Where the frog turns into a prince, and all this stuff. It's all same symbolism. And again, the number of depictions of this in statues, people send them now around the world. This is one. There's another one, again, the part serpent, part human, and the human serpent connection. Again, there's another one.
Oh my God.
And then we come to shape shifting. You know, I've taken some really cool in my time, I think I can recall. when I started talking about shape shifting, they said to me, you can't solid body, another solid body, haven't you known? I know, I'm the first one to say that. Of course you can't. That's not what shape-shifting is. Because that's why the first section today is so vital to understanding who we are. We're energy. We only appear to be physical solid, what we are, when we decode into the holographic world. The shift, which becomes the shape-shift, doesn't happen at this level. It happens at the energetic level. So one time you are decoding an energy field, I've got a picture more apt to put up here. One minute you are decoding an energy field, a vibrational field, which is the human field. That's something that's human. Vibrational, electrical, decoding, holographic, human, you're human. And then there's an energetic shift here, on the vibrational level. And suddenly, you're going, decoding a different vibrational field into a different electrical information, different holographic decoding. So, the shift, physical, only takes place in the decoding system. It's like channel 1, channel 2, channel 1. But, you know, try telling that to a tabloid journalist. Not easy. Each day the world called by 7 foot dishes. That's it? We're not going any further? No. Okay. So, the Queen, like all of us, at this level, is a hologram. Not solid at all. This is where shape-shifting takes place. Physical, apparent physical, in the head. Okay, the roads of tyranny. These bloodlines go back way, way in what we call time, anyway, our perception of it. And they've come through history, and as they've come through history, they've gathered more and more power, centralized more and more power. People say, why don't these reptilians just come and take over? Because they bloody can't. That's why. They have to get us to control ourselves through their hybrid vehicles. So the idea has been to centralize and centralize power more and more and more to the point where they can take control of the planet. It's taken a long time. And they're heading now, as we experience this, into that period where they think they can do it. And they will, for a few years, go along that road. And it will see that all is lost. And then, bang. See ya. I promise you, if I've ever said anything, I really believe. There's times in your life when you hit a bloody rich valley and things come to you in various ways that really, oh my God, I can see it now. I tell you, it's coming down because there are other forces at work. But it's coming down soon. Now we need to slow down this advance so it's not as advanced as it would be by the time it comes down. It may be easier if we do that. We've got some challenges to come, I tell you, but it's going down. It's not going to be here forever or even nearly forever. So, people talking, ancient accounts talk about these civilizations, these massive islands in the Atlantic of the Pacific called the Muriel Mu and the Atlantic, called Atlantis. Atlantis. But, you know, I'm always got my mind open. There was a Greek philosopher called Socrates who was supposed to have said, wisdom is knowing how little we know. And if you do that, then you're always open to other possibilities. And, you know, it's not impossible. I'm not saying this is true. It's not impossible. Actually, these places called Atlantis were actually not on this planet. But anyway, it's very possible. But the stories are related of these societies, these civilizations, as if they were in the Pacific and the Atlantic. But certainly, there were massive cataclysms on this Earth which related to the land, the blocks of land sinking, that's for sure. And this cataclysm can be found in the biological and the geological evidence in history. And when you put, and there's a book called When the Earth Nearly Died, which I read years ago now by two guys. And what they did is they looked at all the ancient accounts all over the world of what the Bible calls the Great Flood. Great cataclysms where the earth turned over and there were catastrophe. And then they look at the biological and geological records, and the terms sink in the most extraordinary way. Clearly, it happened. And there were great changes, and the Earth was in catastrophic state. And that was the time of schism. And how they created the energetic schism led to that. The two are completely related. One was the energetic schism, and the physical catastrophe was the decoding schism playing out, and tremendous geological catastrophe. Noah and the Great Flood, all that stuff, is the Bible symbolism of that. Because Noah in the Bible is just another name for a guy who's talked about in ancient Mesopotamia long before the Bible. Like I say, this energetic schism and the great changes in human perception, the great changes in what we could decode, and the great fantastic changes in how life was before, and this great cataclysm was completely connected. And we went from that to a situation where this control system began to create what it has created. And we decode a much narrower band of reality now than we did before. And that's the prism, the perception prism, the decoding prism, which is creating an imprisonment of the mind. So, control perception is what it's all about all the time. Now, as the Earth began to recover, there were certain advanced societies starting to appear. Here are some of them. And yet, when you go and look at these societies and their history and their accounts and their legends, bingo, serpent gods, serpent symbolism, all over the place. And it was this knowledge, this advanced knowledge from these entities, that led to these great structures all over the world, some of which we struggle to know today. This is in Peru. Just incredible. You get cigarette paper between these rocks. Hundreds of tons. How do they do that? With advanced knowledge, the Nazca lines in Peru. You can only see these images from like 1,000, 2,000 feet. They're plain in their entirety. And we narrow it and come to China again, massive serpent symbolism. That's what the dragon and all that stuff in Japan. You start coming to this area, which is very, very significant in terms of those families that are in control, the events today, or control institutions, etc. today. And we come even closer to this area, Sumer, in what we now call Iraq. They've gone into Iraq for many reasons. Some of it's oil, but it's not even the major reason. Some of it's strategic conquest. But there's another reason. That area, Mesopotamia, the land between two rivers, is of fundamental importance, I think energetically, in terms of vortexes and stuff like that, but also even historically. Because so many of the bloodlines that are now controlling governments and banks and military and all the rest of it actually originated out of this area. And this empire, super empire, was at one point. And what do the Sumer clay tablets, thousands of them that were dug up and gone in the 19th century and since, talk about? The so-called Sumerian tablets, they talk about a non-human race called the Anunnaki, which appears to translate as those who from heaven to earth came, interbreeding with humans, creating hybrid bloodlines. And this is a constant common theme. And these bloodlines came out of that area, expanded out, wherever they went, they became the ruling royal bloodlines, the ruling elite, the aristocracy. One of the locations that they settled in became known as Rome. They created the Roman Empire. Wherever these people went, there was an empire. So you had the Babylonian Empire, which followed in Mesopotamia from Sumer. You had the Roman Empire. They moved up and parked their boat, if you like, in London, in Britain. You had the British Empire. They took control of other European countries. You had the French Empire, the Belgian Empire. They moved to America, then America started expanding. They do it wherever they go, because that's the nature of their mentality. historical church from which the whole of Christianity emerged. And the church of Rome was the church of Babylon relocated, which is why the holy days of Babylon, church of Babylon, are the holy days of the Roman church of Christianity today, using different names. And then, after they settled in Edinburgh, London, and Babylon, London, as it's rightly called, Europe, particularly London, though, then they expanded across the world. And they took with them the secret society network, which I'll come to as we go along. The secret society network is a web of interconnected secret societies, semi-secret organizations, and other organizations that the public know about, but don't know the real reason for them. And their job is to put the bloodlines into position, and their donors, lower levels, into positions of power. Because in doing that, they're putting these reptilian entities wearing these bloodlines into those positions of power. And so when they moved through the colonialization into North America, what became the United States, into Africa, into Australia, and whatever, the people were in a position where they knew where they were. They were in a colonial situation. They knew where they were controlled from, at least on one level. Now that has a finite life. Because if you know your control, and you know who's controlling you, at least on one level, as I say, then you have a target to rebellious. The greatest form of control is the control you cannot see, touch, and taste. Symbolically, you're sitting in a prison cell where you can't see the bars. And what they did when they brought colonial rule to an end, and I have to say, when you look at deep research, the American Revolution was actually orchestrated from Britain. They wanted it. Why did they want it? Because they were moving from in-your-face, I can see, touch, and taste it dictatorship into covert dictatorship. That is a finite life. It might take a time, but it's a finite life. This kind of dictatorship can go on forever until it's exposed, because people don't understand it's not being free when they think they are. So what happened? It happened all over the British Empire, the French Empire, and all of them. As they appeared to go back and leave those countries on the surface, they let out in those countries A, the bloodline, and B, the secret society network through which that bloodline manipulates society. And so America has never been free. It's just a different kind of weapon. And this is the wrong set up now. Think of it as a spider. Well, no, look at that. Think of it as a transnational corporation. Well, what you've got with one of those is you've got the headquarters, and then in the different countries all over the world, you've got a subsidiary company that answers to the dictates of the headquarters. What they've set up is exactly the same, except it's secret societies. So the center of the web, at operational level anyway, is in Europe. Very, very big now in America too, but its operation is in Europe. And in each country, let's take the United States, Africa, South Africa, anywhere, they have a subsidiary network of secret societies and bloodline families. You look in any country, the leading families, the Rockefellers and people like that in America, and the Bushes, they have in America a network of secret societies, Skullbones, Freemasons, all of this stuff, and families, and their job is to control that country's, to say to everyone, that country's politics, any political party that has any chance of power, its banking and finance, its military, its media, its transnational corporations and cartels, etc. And so when the headquarters dictates the agenda, which is projected very long into what we call the future, and I'll come to why that is and how that's possible as we go along, then their job in each country is to set about making that happen in their sphere of influence, their country. And this is why, as I travel around the world, I've seen the same legislation being introduced in different countries about the same time, justified by the same reasons. Sometimes I've seen the wording is virtually the same. This is how they do it, through this structure they've created. That was said, spider's wings. And the closer you are to the spider, the more secretive the organisation, I'm not talking in any kind of order, by the way, although I've got that in order, the more secretive it is, and the further you go out, the less secretive it is. So here, you're starting to interact with mainstream society. And this is the key, because this is the control system of P, and it's not yet, but this, the House of Rothschild, is fundamental within this reality to playing this thing out. This is why all those internet. There are others too, but they're major, major players. And because they control all these different things, they control the game. Unless you understand what the game is, and then you can see it, because you can connect the dots. The idea is to literally tie the world up so that everyone and everywhere is dependent on everyone else and everywhere else, so that there is no ability to independently have self-sufficient decisions. No, you can't do that because of that. Okay, no, you can't do that because of that. That's the idea. That's what globalization is all about. So we see loads and loads of different names in corporations across the great swathe of society. But if you go back and back and back and back and back to the front directors and the nominee directors and all that stuff, they all lead to the same force. This is, like I said earlier, this is Neil Hay's symbolic representation, the Illuminati, the bloodlines, and the secret society network, but ultimately controlled by this force just outside of physical life, to put us there. But we don't have to be there, we can get out of there, it's just a case of becoming conscious. The reason they're desperate to keep us in mind, and low levels of mind at that, is because when we become conscious, we see it. And I don't actually know exactly the reason for this, but they are terrified of humans. Well, you know, terrified. There you go. And they think that it's now just a piece of cake, just going to play out, no problem. It ain't. It is still right. It's going to seem as if all life is lost, and then be gone. Goodbye. There you go. Yeah, the magazine in Britain, well, that went from page, you'd say to me, out of me, you know, I thought, that's a good picture, I like that one. But what do you like? I can care less. And again, you know, this stuff that you see, this is what's actually going on, symbolized by Neil Hay here. So we look at their 5 cents level, and that's what we see. But behind that is something very different. You know, Obama and Blair, they remind me so much of each other. This, the smarmy kind of arrogance, the big fake smile. You say, Barack, you want that, funny man. Big smile here. Blair was exactly the same. But what you notice is their eyes don't smile with them. There you go. Now, I have experience, I've got to tell you about this one. This is a guy from Teddy. He was Prime Minister of Britain from 1970 to 1974, and he was the man who took us into what's now the European Union, and he was obsessive to do so. I was in the Green Party towards the end of the 80s, 1989, and we had the biggest result that the Green Party's ever had. Not as big, various reasons of environmental programs and stuff, water protection, anyway. As a result of that, for the first time in the party's history, spokesmen for the Green Party were asked to go on to the election programmes when the results were coming in, the European elections, 1989. And I was asked by Sky Television, which is satellite television. So I arrive, and I get there by this lady, and she takes me into this Labour room. And it's empty, my room is empty. And she sits me in the chair, she's still going to be on in a minute, and she walks out, and it's empty. The door's open, it's all packed. So I'm sat there, and then somebody caught my eye, and it was cross. What? Sitting in a chair behind the door, by the scene. And he'd just been interviewed, and he was out of waiting for the plane to take off. So, friendly, I said, all right, how are you doing? Not a word. Not a titter. Not even a change of facial expression. This is what happened. I'm there. And by the way, I'm not into any of this stuff that was done. It's 1989. My head's not gone off yet. I'm just a television presenter supposed to be drink by. Anyway, what he did when I said hello is he turned his chair, swiveled in his chair, and he looked at me. Never said a word. I'm not looking at him. And then his eyes started at the top of my head, straight through. I started at the top of my head, and they went slowly down my body, very slowly, to the floor, went all the way back again very slowly to the top of my head. And when he got there, he turned, faced the mirror, and it all was there. That's strange. No, but this is the thing. When all I can describe it as he was scanning me. And when he's doing it, every single part of his eyes went totally black, including the whites. Total pitch black. And years later, when I'm into this stuff and I'm traveling, I kept picking up, regularly, but here and there, in different parts of the world, these stories of what they call the black eyed people, and they're the people whose eyes are absolutely black. And I said to my family later, I said, guess I'm funny, it's spread around the teeth. And one of the things is, when his eyes went black, you know, when you look at people in the eye, you make eye contact. But when I looked at his eyes when this was going on, there was no point which I could make contact. And he came, I described to my family later, I said, well, that's two black holes. And I was looking through into something. I had no idea at the time, but now I'm looking through into this other level where the possessing entity exists. And when I started researching all this later on in 1990, who should come up as a Satanist and child killer than this guy? And I put in my book the biggest secret that this guy is a multiple child killer. And I know even more now, he's not even multiple, it's incredible. He's there now, but when I published the book, he was seriously alive. And a journalist rang him and said, this guy, I've said this about his book. Not a titter, nothing. He just said, oh, he's mad. And that's it, nothing else. Because it's true. So these people are not what they see. There you go. Oh, that. Look at that. Which one's the reptilian? Bloody eyes. You can't get on with your sacrifice, would you have it? But like I say, because of this lack of empathy, these people have no limit to the mayhem they will visit upon. When you look at the aristocratic families, again and again you'll see the symbolism of the flying serpent. Symbolic flying serpent, the ships and all the rest of it. And then Babylon God. This very heart center in so many ways of this whole conspiracy has operational weather. This is the very symbol of the city of London. Not the great conglomeration of London, the original London, which is now the financial district, is a heart with a support leader of the heart. And this is their very symbol. The flying serpent and the Red Cross of the Knights Templar on one level, secret society. The Red Cross, to get this guy's work, etymology goes back, Red Cross, into the serpent. There you go, London. And this is a very, very important point globally, where the city of London, this is the financial district on this side, and this is the area in London known as the Temple. This is the standard, not just for the British, but global law. And it's called the Temple because the land used to be owned by the secret society called the Knights Templar, which fundamentally is still involved in this part of London. And right at the point where these two fundamentally important areas of London and the world meet, flying reptiles on the plane. This is a painting by Fredo Lutwa on the side of one of his huts, depicting a Zulu story about the Chitaburi and what have you. And this is Alfa Romeo, the symbol. And there's the Red Cross again, our old friend. You start to read the sign. This is Berlusconi, leader of Italy, many times, total crook. A member of the P2 Freemasonry Lodge, which was exposed in the 70s, early 80s, the terrible thing that it did. He was on the bloody list, he was a member then, that's what he was from leader, isn't he? And this is in the garden of one of his mansions. The gargoyles and stuff on the churches, on the mansions of the aristocracy, etc., all symbolic of these reptilian entities. And again, I've been coming back to this, the whole foundation is the control of perception, keeping us in the dot, and that's why this control network of families, hybrids, reptilian hybrids, are the ones that have created the belief systems that control today. The religions, the secret societies, the celebrity cults, all of them, all these different beliefs come from these entities, because they have to hold us in the dot, in the mind. These are people who have been hypnotized in a stage of this show. This is what happens to people symbolically all the time. Their eyes are open, they're walking around, but they're in a hypnotic state because of these different prisons of the mind, belief systems, and they all come from the same force. To see that we have no power. Now, this is kind of interesting. What you find when you research this on many different levels is the religions, the secret societies, and Satanism have the same origin. And that origin are these serpent gods and their visible light representatives, if you like. When you look at the religions and you go back to their origin, it's staggering. They all come from the same stable. All of them. They may have different names, they may appear to have different beliefs, although it's kind of slightly, but they all come from the same force and the same background, the same origin. And again, here's the religion factory, be back there. Hinduism, Judaism, Islam, Christianity, way! Same place the bloodlines came out of. Not the bloodlines you see all over the world, this is really what it was. And again, we're into symbolism to hide the real nature of the force involved. So, moon and sun worship, moon goddess, sun god, etc. worship, is our reptilian codes. And that's why we bring the religions back to their origin. They're all sun and moon god, goddess worshipping cults. And one of the reasons that they use, for instance, the sun gods, because, again, this word, derivative, etymology, absolutely nails it again, something I've been saying for years. These entities, when they come into visible light, appear to shine. Maybe it's because of the energetic incompatibility, the energetic difference, I don't know, but they seem to shine. And so, again, you follow word derivatives back for descriptions of the serpent gods, and they become the shining ones. They become the bringers of light, Lucifer, light bringer, and the sun gods. This is where it comes from. And so, this is a depiction of the sun god and the moon goddess from Ur, in what is now Iraq, from 2000 BC. This is the international logo of Islam. I think there's some connection. You know what Allah was? He was a moon god. Provable fact. One of many, many gods in Arabia, and Mohammed decided he was going to be the only god, so he became a moon god. What was he named before? The god Sin, the moon god Sin, S-I-N. That's why we're all sinners. Or not. Again, wherever you go to these religions, this is, you know, this is Hinduism on one side there. It's the moon goddess and the sun god and all the rest of it. This is Salt Lake City, the Mormon church. Look at it. Inverted pentagram, classic symbol of Satanism. And so when you look at the Mesopotamian belief system, you find that the Babylonian Trinity had Queen Semiramis, also known as Ishtar, and many other good names, by the way. You see all these goddesses, all these pretty goddesses, there's so many goddesses. No, different names for the same simple deity in different cultures. And then you had Nimrod, Bel, also known as the sun god. And then you had Tammuz, who was the virgin-born sun. That was the Trinity. And so when the bloodlines that located in Rome and created the Roman Church, they took the Church of Babylon with them. That's why the depiction in Babylon of the Queen Semiramis and the child of Tammuz, Nimrod, as they said, child Tammuz was the reincarnation of Nimrod, therefore father and son were one, where's that comes from? They transferred that to Jesus and Mother Mary when they got to Rome and when the Christian church started to emerge. But they were different names for the same thing. This is why you've got Isis in Egypt and the Virgin born Horus in the same depiction. And this is why around the world you have the mother and Virgin born son all over the place. Universal. And again, you know, which I think, you know, so many depictions in those Ubaid figurines were of the mother of baby. This is Queen Semiramis, the goddess of Babylon, symbolic of the deities, the serpent race. And I've seen her somewhere before. Statue of Liberty was given to New York by French Freemasons in Paris who knew what it really represented, the goddess of Babylon. They use a lot of that, what I call reverse symbolism. They'll tell you this is what it means, liberty, but actually it means we control the place, and we're showing you, we can't see it, can you? Queen Semiramis on an ancient coin. This is the Statue of Liberty, not in New York, but on the island of Riverside in Paris, where the New York one came from. Exactly the same. But Babylon. So the goddess of the French Republic, same. Goddess of Babylon. Same with the goddess of freedom, same with the goddess of Colombia. Then the goddess of Babylon was symbolized as a dove, Nimrod, Tammuz was symbolized as the sun, so you have in the Vatican, you have that symbolism in a prominent place. And by the way, the dove, in French, the word dove is Colombo. And so when they moved from Babylon to Rome, they worshipped Queen Semiramis as Venus Columba, Venus the dove. And that's what Columbia is in America. It's the dove, it's the bloodline controlling, it's the goddess of Babylon, the goddess of the serpents. And in Rome also, there's another word, and I came across the other day in this pre-conversation talk, where you think you know this. It's Columba, not Columba, Columba, E-R. And that means serpent. That means serpent race. So we've got that is the basis for all religions. So we've got to move on to Nimrod. In Babylon, they symbolize Nimrod as a flame or a lighted torch. That is why she's holding a lighted torch, the torch of Nimrod. That is why she's standing on a symbol of the sun. Because it's the moon goddess of Babylon and the sun god of Babylon. That's why, right on top of the pond down the tunnel, the brittle passage of the moon goddess, by the way, in Paris, where Diana died. Diana is another name for the moon goddess. They have on top of there, the place where they take their tributes, a massive and exact depiction of the flame held by the Statue of Liberty. They also symbolize, again, I knew this before from other research, but this derivative word book shows it very clearly from that perspective. They symbolize the serpent god also in terms of fish, because of the scales and all the rest of it. And this is the a serpent god of Mesopotamia, they call it Dagon. Just another name. That's how they symbolized in essence a Babylonian replica of original Babylonian fiction. This is obviously drawn from it. And I've seen that somewhere before. There you go. That's what that is. Because the Church of Rome was the Church of Babylon, which is the Church of the Serpent Gods. The penis of Osiris, Nimrod, and all these different names for the same basic deity is symbolized by the obelisk. That's why Freemasonic lodges are obsessed with obelisks. War memorials all over Britain are obelisks. I mean, you know, can we be more creative? Why do I have the obelisks and what it means? What do they have in Washington? The biggest obelisk in the world. studied the religions, and what they've done is play off religion against religion when they're all from the same source. And in the end, like everything else, all the religions are controlled by the same network. Same with the New Age. You know, New Age came out of the 60s. When you look at the 60s, that was a lot of absolutely massively contrived others. I love the music, man. I live through it, but when you look back, and it became morphed into the New Age. And I know people who were with Kissinger in the 70s and stuff who were saying they never crave that. These guys are very strong and all this business connected into the environment stuff and the New Age. And again, when you, not all the New Age, big aspects of it. What is it about? It's about hierarchy. It's about hierarchy of angels. Well, what are the bloody angels? What are the words that are driven back? Serpent gods. Then you have the Great White Brotherhood, all this stuff. Hierarchy. Hierarchy is mind. Consciousness doesn't do hierarchy because consciousness knows we're all one. If it's hierarchy, it's mind. And so all these things, religions, are to hold us here while thinking we're, connecting with the great gods and all that stuff. And now we come to energy vampire, which I talked about earlier. These guys are outside of visible life, but they're not in there drinking blood to stay here. They feed off human energy. And human energy is changed dramatically by our sense of our state, our state-mind, our sense of being. Another guy in Japan, I spent a whole weekend with him once, called Mr. Imoto. And he's the guy who found a way of switching water and photographing the crystals. He used to do it. I've been in his studio where he does it. That's been done very quickly, but it's great. And what he's done, he does wonderful books with pictures. He gets a receptacle of water, and he will just write, because when you say it, or when you write it, it carries the same vibration. He writes like love and affection on one. He will put hate on another one. He will put a mobile phone on another one. And then he will freeze the water very, very quickly and photograph the crystals. The difference is extraordinary. This is a crystal photograph which had words of love and affection written on the side of the receptacle. This is one that had hate written on the side. The difference in vibration, the difference in energy is fantastic, and this is the energy, because of their state of being, that these entities can absorb. They can't absorb this. You know, when we start acting on that vibe, they're going to go bloody under it, right? This is again the same one. This is mobile phones. This is a water crystal that had a mobile phone attached to it. No one rang the call. I don't know, I'm pretty easy. And so all these things that have happened, wars and suffering and famine and all, it's all, they're all feeding these entities. So they want the world as it is. That's why it's as it is. It's made to be like that if you know what the outcome is wanted to be. And of course, in the Matrix, they use the symbol of the machines that were feeding off human energy. And this Morpheus character says they turn human beings into one of these, and on one level they have through the process I'm talking about. Which brings us to religion. There's no more powerful connection, energetic connection you can make than focus, attention. And when you move that step onto worship, that connection is even stronger. And so what's happening in the old saying, energy flows where attention goes, is they set up these religions where the deities all symbolically represent them. And through that, an energetic connection is made between the worshipper and them, unknown to the worshipper. So as you focus your worship on these deities, you're feeding them very powerfully your energy. So energy flows where attention goes. 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 Everything flows on ascension terms. And again, all feeding in to this same force. And there's certain other things, the money system, all of it, feeding energy to these people, these entities. And look at some of the images that they focus on, the suffering, sacrifice, torture. But that's what it is. And within his mind, I mean, big consciousness in awareness of itself worships its deity. It's everything. Mind worships deity because mind thinks in terms of a partner. Consciousness doesn't worship anything. It just is. And these religions made of mind, because of that, because they're not conscious, can be played off against each other in the fragmentation world of mind to create divided rule. Which they do. And it's all the same. What it is in there, cut off the channels of consciousness. And then, at the same time, you realize that these serpent gods that are worshipped from religion are actually also worshipped a bit more, not surprised this bit, by the secret societies. And all of them. And again, most of the initiates, like the followers of religion, have no idea that this is so, because it's all compartmentalized. So here we have the eye of, this is CBS, this is AOL, those of them, if you want to look for them, dollar bill, this is the eye of the watchers. And when you call the group back, here we are, watches, serpent gods. Wherever you look. And this is why you find symbolism in religious and symbolism in secret society. It's claimed, you know, this is a suicide block, this is in the back. I took this in a pre-masonic lodge in Boston, which is an area. I was speaking in Boston, and this is a big lodge, and we walked in, and there's nobody there, and I just kept walking, walked up the stairs, and like Mary Celeste. Walked into the temple, sat down, had a picture taken. Didn't call the child, I'll let that out, right? We took these pictures, and no one was there. And then eventually, we see by people, but we took a lot of pictures. And here we go, that was in the lodge, above the chair. The rising sun, symbolic of the serpent gods. In Washington, D.C., just down from the White House, there you have the rising sun again. And it's this is the 33rd degree Supreme Headquarters of the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry. And over the Downing Street, the door where the Prime Minister goes in, there it is again. Even got the rays of the sun in between. And there's CBS, there we go. The rising sun. One of the key symbols. This is on the side of that Boston Freemasonic Lodge. Again, the sun, it's still worshipping the same religions, the same gods. This is the mother lodge of Freemasonry in London. And it was from here, in 1717, I think it was set up, that Freemasonry was launched into the colonies of the United States. That became the United States. And where did they put this mother lodge of Freemasonry in London? They put it on Great Queen Street. Great Queen was one of the names in Babylon, the Queen's the nearest to the moon goddess of Babylon. And so they called her in Babylon the Virgin Queen. Again, same symbolism. And so Virginia wasn't named after the Virgin Queen of England, Queen Elizabeth I. First of all, she was no more a virgin than Madonna. And secondly, it wasn't about her at all. Virginia was named after the Virgin Queen of Babylon. It's all symbolism all over the place. And most Freemasons, people in these secret societies, don't know that because of the compartmentalization. Most people in Freemasonry have got three levels of degree. And even the top level of the secret societies is not the top level. What happens is, you've got the secret societies, Freemasons, Knights of Malta, all these things, and they feed a chosen few, bloodline, through into this one level that we never talk about, that don't claim not to exist, the Illuminati pyramid. And this is basically compartmentalized as well. And that's where the real action is. And even here, won't know what that goes or anything like. See, the number of people in full knowledge, very, very few. But it's the servant gods that are behind it. Again, all these secret societies answer to the same master. They're all different strands on the same web. And that's what they've done to the earth. Now, this is interesting. Control agenda is projected long into what we call the future. How do they do that? How do they know about technology here, which is necessary to take it further back here? Simple. These entities are operating outside of visible life. This matrix we're in, this isolated part of the virtual reality universe, and they're moving up and down the timeline. Well, physically assigned. They know what's coming here. And when they need technology, say, they reach a point where they cannot impose further centralization of control without computers, then they should use computers through the bloodline. Goes on an underground basis. What they do then is they concoct here a cover story. Oh, this nerd is coming, this is Jared, it's Jared, okay. Then we reach the point where they are now. And right back here, because they're moving up and down the timeline, they know what's coming. Now this is the point. Therefore, if you can access the agenda at any point in this timeline, you know what's coming. And so you can things. And this is interesting. Therefore, one of the strands, big strand in the web, is called the Fabian Society. It's created in 1884, and it is the force that created the British Labour Party of Tony Blair, etc. And much more, it operates around the world in other countries too. George Bernard Shaw, the writer H.G. Wells, all these people were involved in it. And he is Fabian. The guy who served the agenda ceaselessly, Tony Blair, and will continue to do so. Now, people say to me sometimes, what do they want? We do what you know they want. 1984, I told you all, what men are everywhere, and a book called Breaking World by All the Objects. 1984 deals with the police inquisition part, and Breaking World details the breeding programs and the use of drugs to get people, the masses, to love their servitude. So, also in Breaking World 1932, George Orwell 1948, 2009, bloody hell, spot on chaps. I've been saying for years, that's not from their imagination, it's from their knowledge. So, what you find is George Orwell, Eric Blair, went to Eton College, the elite college in Britain all the royal children go to, and his French teacher, for a time, was Aldous Huxley. But they became friends, and they both became members of the Fabian Society. As a result of that, both got access through the Fabian Society to this projected agenda. And that's how it was possible for them to write those books that now prove to be so really accurate. And in people that, and when you look at 1984, it wasn't set in 1984, really, it was set about now, really. And what people have pointed out is George Orwell, when he accesses his agenda, seems not prepared in any way. And he wrote 1984 to, as in code, to expose the agenda of the Fabian Society. And it is said that he called it 1984 because 1984 was the centenary year of the Fabian Society, starting in 1884. Whatever, they accessed that agenda. And other people have done so at different points, and that's why they've been so prophetic. Now, the satanic connection comes from the fact, and again, this interlocks with the secret societies, comes from two things. One, the need for these reptilian entities, when they enter visible life, to drink human blood to stay here longer, and also the fact that they feed on human flesh. I mean, they eat people. I mean, that's, they're doomed. I mean, they've been doing it right away through history, as they're now shown. And also, these rituals, these satanic rituals, they create, the most powerful of them anyway, they create an energetic field which allows these entities to move into visible life. from outside. I know people, I've met people around the world who've been in satanic rituals and they've watched these energies appear. They appear because the ritual creates the energetic stepping stone, if you like, that allows them to come in. And these Satanists, by the way, are bloody terrified. And so, all this thing about Dracula, you know one of the word derivatives of angels and the serpent gods in all this research? Nocturnal gods. They come out at night. And this is a common thing, a really common thing. Dracula comes out at night, exists in the day. Shapeshifts. He's a count, symbolic of this whole royal bloodline of the hybrids. Bram Stoker was talking about something that was real when he was talking about Dracula. It's certainly in theme. And this other guy here, Vlad the Impaler, in what became known as Transylvania and now Romania, he was a major guy within this whole hybrid bloodline, and he did it. He used to impale people, thousands of people, that's when he came down as Vlad the Impaler. He used massive blood drinkers, Jewish public, and all the rest of it. And he was a member of something called the Royal Court of the Dragon, which is a secret society of the bloodlines going right back to Egypt, and he became a member of it. And he, Mary of Teck, who is the grandmother of the present Queen of England, is a direct descendant of Vlad the Impaler's sister. I see how the bloodline passes through history. So these things, in B movies and stuff, are actually happening. All this stuff involving children is happening. You notice all this symbolism through history about sacrificing young virgins to the gods. Well, A, it was the serpent gods, and B, young virgin, what was that? Children! Have you ever seen this film, Eyes Wide Shut, by the last movie of Stanley Kubrick? It was played, I know a guy, Jay Weiner, who I met last year, who is now producing a fantastic sounding biography of Kubrick, both in book form and in documentary. And he was telling me that within next to no time, hours of the film company executives watching the cut of Eyes Wide Shut, he was there, Kubrick. And they took 15 minutes out of it, which no one's ever seen. And when you see how far it went in the elite taking part in these rituals, what was in the 15 minutes no one's ever seen, and they Warner Brothers refused to release. Also, therapists who were working with satanically abused people, children, and who, later in life start to remember things. They sent me these drawings that their clients have done, with their clients' permission of course, trying to get out the memory, and again, it's the serpent eyes that they see. Bohemian Grove, Northern California, where they go to their summer camp every year. At Bohemian Grove, all the elite, the Bush family, the Rockefellers, the Kissinger, all these people, and wider afield, they go and they do rituals under a 40-foot stone owl. These are the people running this country and other countries. And the owl, it represents the goddess of Babylon, Ishtar or Semiramis, as well as being a representative of a deity called Moloch, which is mentioned in the Bible, and it's mentioned in relation to a child sacrifice. And so the owl, again the etymology goes back to the serpent gods, the nocturnal god. The owl comes out at night. If you watch the symbolism, you start to pick up how they're encoding these things. So the owl is a big symbol of the serpent gods, and I just drew a line around the road system within the complex of the Congress Building, Capitol Hill. And it's a clear owl with Congress in its belly. They love their symbolism, these people. And here's another one from a map, and it's standing on a pyramid. The Washington Street Plan is extraordinary. And you can find it around the world. This is Canberra. That's the Canberra Parliament Building. Same thing. There you go. These people worship a deity, 40-foot stone owls. You couldn't make the brother up. And here is Bohemian Grove in 1958, This is Glenn Seaborg, who gave the world plutonium. Cheers, Glenn. And over here, is a then B-movie actor called Ronald Reagan. Over here is Tricky Dicky Nixon. Both members of Bohemian Grove, both became presidents of the United States. This is the force behind, and I'm not just talking about America, Mike, what is it, the force behind British politics and the British system? My bloody God, is it? And so, I hope that might be going on, some of the things to get through. But this is also fascinating when you look at this. We live in a reptilian world. Why? Because of something called the reptilian brain, which we all have. Carl Sagan was a cosmologist who bloody knew more than he was saying. And he wrote a book, he's setting up with this, called The Dragon's Leap, in which he was looking at the connection between reptilian genetics, basically, and the reptilian history, and human behavior. People don't realize that a fundamental part of the human brain is called by scientists the reptilian brain, or the R-complex. And it's fundamental to human behavior. When you see its traits, you're looking at human society. This is Don Juan Matos being quoted in Carlos Castaneda's books all those years ago. And I've come to certain conclusions, and I've never read Castaneda's stuff, but then I read these quotes and I thought, my God, he's so accurate. This is what the Central American shaman is quoted as saying. We have a predator that came from the depths of the cosmos and took over the rule of our lives. Human beings are its prisoners. The predator is our lord and master. It has rendered us docile, helpless. If we want to protest, it suppresses our protest. If we want to act independently, it demands that we don't do so. Indeed, we are a prisoner. They took us over because we are food to them, and they squeeze us mercilessly because we are their sustenance. Just as we rear chickens in coops, the predators rear us in human coops. Human are us. And therefore, their food is always available to them. Think for a moment and tell me how you would explain the contradictions between the intelligence of man, the engineer, and the stupidity of his systems of belief, or the stupidity of his contradictory behavior. Sorcerers believe that the predators have given us our systems of beliefs, our ideas of good and evil, our social mores. They are the ones who set up our dreams of success or failure. They have given us our covetousness, greed, and cowardice. It is the predator who makes us complacent, routinary, and egomaniacal. In order to keep us obedient and meek and weak, the predators engage themselves in a stupendous maneuver. Stupendous, of course, from the point of view of our fighting strategist. An horrendous maneuver from the point of those who suffer it. They gain us their mind. The predator's mind is baroque, contradictory, morose, and filled with fear of being discovered any minute now. Constant recurring theme. We have the power. We only finally understand it and use it. But that is brilliant. That's a brilliant description of what's going on. This is the situation. The reptilian minds connect into our body computer via the reptilian brain. And when we switch that off, we switch them on. All these different people, in the system are connected to the control system through the reptilian brain, and if we fall into mind and fight sense of awareness only, we drop in there too. And crucially, if we fall into fear, we drop in there for reasons I'll come to. This is official science, this is not me kind of work, I've discovered this, this is mainstream science here. From the reptilian brain, we get primitive and emotional responses. Emotional responses. Dinner? Everybody? Dinner? Cold-blooded behavior and territoriality. Cold-blooded behavior, what's that? No empathy with the consequences for others of your actions. Absolutely. Territoriality, control, ownership, mind. A desire to control, doesn't sound like them. An obsession with hierarchical structures of power. Look at our society, it's a hierarchy of all these different levels. Aggression, might is right, winner takes all. And through the reptilian brain, they have hijacked our perception, and they feed us fear. Why? There are some good traits of the reptilian brain, but when it gets in the driving seat, then we're in real trouble. What the reptilian brain is doing all the time, doesn't think, it reacts. That's what it does. Because it's constantly scanning the environment for danger. Danger to our survival. Not just physical survival, survival in many other ways. And it's that which kicks in, reacts, and you react with it. And then a little while later, another part of the brain starts to go look back and you go, I was over the top, wasn't I? I shouldn't have said that, should I? This doesn't think, it reacts. A good side of this is when you're going down the road and someone walks in front of your car, the thing that bangs the brakes on is this. Because it's constantly scanned, so it's a good thing. But when it takes over, then it scans everything in terms of survival, fear, all these things. So, be afraid, be very afraid. Big bad monster's coming as soon as we've invented it. And then we'll whack him in through here, okay? So, terrorism! Ah! Global warming! Ah! Swine flu! Ah! Economy! Ah! I don't like her! Ah! I don't like him! Ah! All through here, all of it! All of it! And it's not just, like I say, physical survival. The reptilian brain is scanning everything in terms of survival. Survival of the belief system. It's scanning the challenges to the belief system. That's why Trump, people, when their belief system is challenged, they go right over the top. Okay, I don't believe in it, no problem. And they attack you, shut him off. Don't say that, you can't say that. Ban him, ban him. My belief system's in trouble, reptilian brain reacting. Reputation, all my reputation under threat for survival, reptilian brain, superiority, intellectual preeminence, like I say, these people who've gone through their lives as kind of feminist academics, and suddenly someone's challenging their belief system on which their reputation is based, reptilian brain kicks in. Acquiescence to hierarchy and authority, reptilian brain. You know, when people have done experiments with this, where an authority figure walks in and something happens energetically to the people who feel less than the authority figure. There's an energetic change, reaction, an emotional reaction. And that directs to the brain, again, because it is hierarchical. I know my place. Well, I bloody don't. And the other thing, is money. Money again, money and possessions. I read a fascinating article in the Los Angeles Times years ago by a French anthropologist, and the story was that they just increased the size of dinner plates in restaurants in Southern California. You know, I took a deep breath, thought how big they could get. But anyway, I had breakfast the other morning. I ate about that much of it. They said, you haven't touched your breakfast. I said, I haven't touched that bit. I haven't touched that bit. Okay. Massive. Oh my God. Anyway, what he was saying was, the cult of excess, as he called it, having far, far more and desiring far, far more than you need, is the reptilian brain, because it associates having far more than is necessary with a greater chance of survival. So you have people who have more money than they can spend in 100 lifetimes, get up with the sun every day to go and earn some more. And then you've got the other side of it, which is people fearing not having enough for meeting the rent at the end of the month, survival of the reptilian brain. We live in a reptilian brain society, which is completely dominating our sense of reality, and is connected to the reptilian brain, controlled perception. And so, let's come into the world we're living now, as they say. We're moving now into a time when they want to play the final cards and complete this takeover that's been moving through. They think they're going to get there, they end. They might get a bit further on, they will, but they ain't going to get there. But the more we can slow it down, the better. And then it won't be as extreme by the time it comes down. So, how are they going to do it? A few. They create a situation in society where they break everything up into pyramids. Organizations, schools, universities, government, they're all pyramids, like secret societies, The few have the knowledge and they pass it over the top levels of the secret society network and they take it out of circulation as much as they can so that people are in ignorance of what they know. That's the first 2.5 hours today, overwhelmingly. They put people into apparent positions of power. I might be optimistic here, I might be lower, but say here, these are the prime ministers and the presidents and all these other people, but they are just there to answer to this and bring in through legislation and stuff what that decides is going to be brought in. And they created a pyramid within pyramid, like Russian dolls structure, where all these different areas, like the religions eventually, are all connected to the same force. The intelligence agencies, same thing. Banking, eventually there's a network of families that control the whole of the banking system through this. The Rothschilds are right up there at the top of all of this. Same with the media. In the end, they own the whole of the mainstream media, the major things anyway. And they own the political parties. And that's how they can push down through all these apparently, at this level, unconnected organisations and institutions, exactly the same agenda. The incessant centralisation of power. And this is how it works with the reptilian outside of visible light in the background. And these people are the middle management, holding it together, don't know what's going on here, don't know what the force is, and these are the silly sods that stand there. Mm. I'm going to hold you too, and all that stuff. This pyramid is held up by us. No more. Gone. That's up there because of this. It wouldn't be up there without this. It just boom. We hold it together. That's where the power is. We can unhold it together. But this is another way, like I say, of describing it in the spider's web way. It's the same thing. And through out of the Illuminati, that all the bloodlines, come all these people around the world that enter the positions of power. And we think we're voting for them. You know, do you want John McCain or do you want Barack Obama? Well, we want Barack Obama, but we have John McCain, he's a man of control as well. And the same thing will play out. And so, in America, what we've got is the Republicans who are controlled by what are called the neocons, the neoconservatives. And the Democrats are controlled by what I call the democons, which are another network. I've called Kissinger the Democons because he's behind Obama, but of course he's been in the Republicans most of the time. And then the Democons and the neocons are controlled by the same force. So it doesn't matter who's in power, the agenda keeps unfolding. Some people do it by looking stupid, some people do it by being fat smiles, but they're the same mass on the same face. So when people say, George Bush is a big brother, it's like your little sister. Same with Obama. They don't know something of what's going on, but they don't be sure as hell supporting it, but they're not the control system. They're just front men selling it. Same force playing out the movie. Moving the cards around the table, no evidence until anything goes. And we are kept in bewilderment and detours and manipulated and not to see it, so we become fucking people and we go round and round and round and round. Like that. Control of perception. Very quickly, because people here will know about this, but I always do this because some people might not, and it's very important. Control of perception. There's two great ways that this control system has moved through this timeline. One is the problem reaction solution, as I call it. You create the problem, you blame someone else for it, you get the public to react with outrage and fear as they do something, and then you offer the solution to the problems you created, which is changing society in ways that advance your agenda. Order out of chaos, the top level of Freemasonry calls it, order out of chaos. Problem reaction solution, same thing. Inside job, 9/11 became the war on terror, became the control system. And again, this is one of the mentors, seriously important mentors, Barack Obama. This is Zbigniew Brzezinski, the National Security Advisor to Jimmy Carter. He's someone else who, through accessing through the Rockefeller family and other sources, he's accessed the projected agenda. And so he's been writing a series of books since 1970 that are predicting exactly what's going on now. But he said in this book in 1997, regarding what became 9/11, really. Moreover, as America becomes an increasingly multicultural society, it may find it more difficult to fashion a consensus on foreign policy issues, except in the circumstance of a truly massive and widely perceived direct external threat. That's what 9/11 was about. A matter of fact, an external threat to justify what followed. These are different similar buildings around the world. One in Madrid, another one in, I think it's Japan, that fiercely, fiercely burned for far, far longer, never collapsed. There you go, in a nutshell. Second World War, problem, reaction, solution. They controlled the Nazis, they controlled the Soviet Union and the American and British, and they played them off against each other. Second World War, big problem. It's a global problem. So many global solutions. And so we have the United Nations, the European Union, and the Bretton Woods Agreement, the World Bank, the IMF, and all this stuff. Problem, reaction, solution. And now there's another version. I call it no problem, reaction, solution. You just need a perception that is one. Weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. No problem, reaction, solution. You still justify the invasion of Iraq. Then there's this other one, the totalitarian tiptoe, I call it, which works with problem, reaction, solution. You're at A, you know you're going there, but if you go too fast, you go, what's going on, what's going on? So do it in steps. As big a steps as you can, but not too big that people see what's going on. As this brilliantly said, do you really think it will be this obvious? Well, actually it's becoming that now, because we're getting to the real number of it. But up to this point it's not been, because of totalitarian tiptoe. European Union went from a free trade area to a fascist centralised dictatorship by the stepping stones. This is the father of Europe, John Monnet, who actually said in a letter to a friend in 1952, Europe's nation should be guided towards the superstate without the people understanding what is happening. This can be accomplished by successive steps, each disguised as having an economic purpose, but which will eventually and irreversibly lead to federation. Totalitarianism, so exactly what they're doing here now to create a North American Union. And this is the facade, the symbol from which we get the word fascism from the Roman Empire, and it's tying together individuality, that symbolises the dictatorship, and that's exactly how the European Union is structured. And if you look behind the speaker in the Congress building, you will see two fascist symbols, the facade. It's in our press. Okay, go straight to tyranny. We've been going through this timeline, and now we're where we are, and this is what they want. And we can see it moving. A world government dictating to every country. A world central bank dictating to all countries, all global finance. A world currency, eventually electronic, not cash, so that when the computer says no to your electronic money, then you have no form of purchase except barter. A world army to impose the will of the world government. A microchip population connected to a satellite computer system and other computer systems. Under that, unions of countries, the African Union, that exists, Pacific Union, that's moving along, American Union, North American, part of that, very close, European Union, that's almost complete. And then under that, nation states and regions, and they want to change nation states into regions and break up the nation state. That's why they're targeting America massively now, to break it up. And under that come the people. That's what they want. There may be another one in there, a Middle Eastern Union or whatever, but that's basically the structure. And through problem, reaction, solution, and the totalitarian tiptoe, they're moving towards that structure all the time, and have been for a long time. And this is one of the chosen people to sell the agenda. Obama. He's a used car salesman. That's why he's in there, to sell the agenda to the people with a smiling face. He comes from one of the most cesspit political systems in the world, Chicago. And to survive in Chicago politics, you either have to be deeply corrupt or acceptable to the corruptible. And he didn't just survive, his star absolutely bloody soared. And this is why he's involved with people like Tony Resco, this slum landlord who went to jail for fraud and all the rest of it, and embezzlement. What we're seeing in America is a presidential version of problem, reaction, solution. First of all, you bring in Bush, and he's the problem. We saw that. He was there up there to front a series of problems, overseas wars, terrorism, and all the rest of it, and right at the end of his presidency, not by accident, they crashed the economy. Then the idea is you get a reaction to Bush. The reaction part, problem, reaction, solution. The reaction to what's happening, economically, wars, all the rest of it, and along comes the solution. Right? Believe. Don't. Now, There's nothing more powerful in mind control than telling people what they want to hear. Use car salesmen and everything, and brilliant at it. Because you're halfway there because they want what you're saying to be true. And so they create this situation of hope, change, all the rest of it. At no point did he define what he meant. Why? Because if he had, he wouldn't have got in. And what they did was a massive mind control operation. They got him to use these trigger words, hope, change, something to believe in, yes we can, no point defining them. And so what he became was a blank sheet of paper, an empty screen for people to project onto him what they define those words as. And so he became literally, apart from those people that were aware, all things to all people. It's a brilliant mind control. But why change? Why did Clinton go change when he first came in? Because of the way the system is, at any point, the status quo is not good for most people. So if someone came along, I'm going to keep things as they are. Look, no chance. Change. I'm going to change. Oh yeah, we need some change. All of that. It's just mind control and trigger words. And they use it over and over. You're falling for it. This is what Hitler said. Make the lie big, make it simple, keep saying it, and eventually they will believe it. Make the lie big, make it simple, keep saying it, and eventually they will believe it. It works. So why do they change it? I don't know, it's very symbolic of Barack Obama. The wolf found the shepherd's clothing and wasn't even done. He attracted more, I wrote some articles about him in October, November. And I've got a lot of criticism for it. The source of the criticism was funny for me, because I thought, you know that there's a control system and both parties control by the same people. Yeah, yeah. So, hold on a second. You're saying that this man, despite all that, has come out of nowhere, decades. He came out of nowhere, he's a genuine man, believes what he says, cares about the people, and he attracts the biggest funding in presidential history from Wall Street sources, and the biggest single donator was Goldman Sachs. So you're saying that these people, you know, are scanning the world, they say, we like this man, we're turkeys and we're going to vote for Thanksgiving, give him some money. And you say, cognitive dissonance. What it was, they wanted him to be genuine. He ain't. It is what it is. It's patient. And he's not to say this guy, Zbigniew Brzezinski, is a key man behind him. And in 1970, this is what Brzezinski said. Again, he's accessed the timeline. The technotronic era involves the gradual appearance of a more controlled society. Such a society will be dominated by an elite, unrestrained by traditional values. Soon it will be possible to assert almost continuous surveillance on every citizen and maintain up-to-date complete files containing even the most personal information about the citizen. These files will be subject to instantaneous retrieval by authorities. 1970. This is a man behind Obama. That's why Obama has been brought in to sell this. Sell this is necessary. Brzezinski, with David Rockefeller, a lifelong part of this manipulation, created this organization called the Trilateral Commission, which is a major part of this group of organizations, which answer to a British secret society called the Round Table. Council on Foreign Relations, 1921, Waterloo International Affairs in London, 1920, Trilateral Commission, 1973, United Nations, of course, after the last war, Bilderberg Group, 1954, that's right, the Bilderberg Hotel in there, and the top of right, 1968, which is to manipulate the environment side, but it's playing a big part now. So if you're involved in any of these organizations, and technically in terms of creating them, you are a major player. He's the mentor of Barack Obama. And what he talks about, Brzezinski, is this area of the world he calls Eurasia, which is a name for it, it's not just made it up, and how controlling this area controls the world. And then you start seeing the countries around Eurasia. Just through here, you've got Israel, which is Israel is the land of Rothschild. Nothing Jewish people, they're just there to people in. The land of Rothschild, completely couldn't give a damn about Jewish people. And then you start moving. Iraq. Iran. That's why they're targeting Iran. They want control of Iran. They want control of this whole area. Afghanistan. Pakistan. They started bombing there now. And that takes us into China. And I picked up a long, long time ago, from various sources, they want ultimately a third world war involving North America, Europe, Russia, and China to create a massive global problem that leads to a complete transformation of global society with a global army and the dismantling of all national armies to stop it happening again. It's all part of problem, the actual solution. And then you look here, Armenia, Georgia, Ukraine, all these areas here which they've been manipulating and infiltrating. They want this whole area. You can keep a map at home, and as the time passes, you'll be taking these bloody countries off. And so you've got Obama's controlled by people like him, but also by financiers like George Soros, and crucially, all these people answer to the Rothschilds. The Rothschilds control this guy ultimately. He's brought Kissinger in, who was a Republican operative, and Kissinger is controlled by the Rothschilds, and also and then you've got this guy, Rahm Emanuel. Rahm Emanuel is the White House Chief of Staff, came out of the Senate of Chicago politics. His father was a member of IRGUN, one of the terrorist organizations that bombed Israel into existence in 1948 and fought, along with other terrorist organizations, some 800,000 Palestinians to leave that country, never to return, out of terror of what was going on. So he is controlled by the Rothschilds massively, and he is the guy who's the nearest controller to Barack Obama. And I just want to make this point. Zionism is nothing to do with the race of Jewish people. As you can see from this, lots of Jewish people reject Zionism. What is Zionism? It was created provably, totally by the Rothschilds. Zionism is a political philosophy. That's what it is. As it plays out in the public. At its core, it is a secret society which locks into the rest of the web, so no expand in the web. And a lot of Jewish people completely reject it. But what they've done is equate Zionism with Jewish people, so if you challenge Zionism, you're an anti-Semite. The Rothschilds built and paid for the Knesset, the Israeli parliament. They built and paid for the Supreme Court in Tel Aviv with all these Illuminati esoteric symbols on it. And as members of the Rothschild family who rejected the family have said, they own Israel lock, stock and barrel. So when they talk about Israel attacking Iran, that's the Rothschild saying that. Netanyahu and Lieberman and Barak and all these people in office in Israel. Now that will be honest, they just do the Rothschild bidding. And then you've got all these hate laws. They've just been introduced in America, been introduced in Canada for some time, been introduced in Europe. And it's been introduced to organizations like B'nai B'rith. Who created B'nai B'rith? B'nai B'rith, the Rothschilds. And B'nai B'rith created the Anti-Defamation League, which goes around defaming people, which is kind of ironic, true. And it's been ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, Rothschild organization to its fingertips, that has been not only behind these hate laws, but wrote the legislation. And it's nothing to do with protecting Jewish people or gays or anybody else from discrimination. It's to protect the Rothschild from legitimate investigation. That's what it's about. Pepper bombing civilian areas, if you say that's outrageous, you're an anti-Semite. And by the way, people in Canada here will know from their so-called human rights commissions, truth is no defense. You can say something that's true and these laws will still prosecute you. That's where we're going. And the Rothschild front man has got the total here of Obama, and the other man in the White House is David Axelrod. This is the man who oversaw all the election campaigns against Hillary Clinton and against John McCain, and he's now the senior White House advisor, Rothschild Zionist. You see on my website, whenever I see Zionist, who were Jewish people. Jewish people have been hung out to dry for generations by these guys. They did it in Germany. So, Axelrod is the one who oversees the words of the teleprompter. He's reading Axelrod's words, and Axelrod's words are the Rothschild words. How lovely, the teleprompter. Without a disgusting idiot. Go onto YouTube and see some of the clips where the autocue goes down. On St. Patrick's Day this year, he walked to the teleprompter. He had a gathering with the Irish Prime Minister and so on, which is Patrick's Day in the White House. He walked to the teleprompter and thanked himself for inviting everybody. Because the Prime Minister of Ireland's words were still there. And this is the other thing, this air of intelligence. He's not intelligent, he reads other people's words like the guy reading the news. He's not reading his own words, he's reading words someone else has read for him in the newsroom. But what people do is they contrast him with Bush. And so he seems to be intelligent, but slow horses go fast when they're running past trees. Great baptism of the people will be more easily fall victims to the big lie than the small one. And that's what it is. Smile, he's such a nice bloke. He's just introduced martial law, but he's ever so good, he's smiling ever so nice. And what this big smile is, this is what it's designed to overshadow.
Bonuses to people.
for getting a mortgage signed. The people didn't have to pretend to pay for it down here, but you got your bonus if you got them to sign the mortgage payments that became official. Some of these guys were running around just wanting to get everybody's signatures on paper because it was another bonus. And all the checks of whether they could pay for it gone. It was a disaster waiting to happen and they crashed it. It all orchestrated by this guy and his associates. And so they got people in debt while they're watching the game and the game show. Oh, it's great, we're in a boom time. Yeah, I'm going to borrow more money. Oh, yeah, let's go. And bingo, crashing. The casino was crashed in September 2008. One of the fundamental players in the crash was Goldman Sachs, Rothschild Control. And who did they have? The Treasury Secretary when the crash came? Former, in 2006, he came out with former Chief Executive Officer of Goldman Sachs, Hank Paulson. And what did he decide to do? What would you think the best thing to do, Hank? Oh, I think it's a good thing to throw trillions of dollars at Goldman Sachs and others that I assume, yeah, let's do that. So we honed, they honed the bloody banks with money, all credit, borrowed with bloody China and everywhere, creating another massive bubble to come. And one of the biggest beneficiaries of it, in fact, jointly the biggest beneficiaries of it, were Goldman bloody Sachs, chief executive until 2006, and Paulson, and AIG's insurance company, which just happened to owe enormous numbers of amounts of money it couldn't pay to Goldman Sachs. This attracted incredible amounts of money from the government, which allowed it to pay back Goldman Sachs. Just a coincidence, nothing to worry about. And then you see the two presidents, because they're so different, you see. They're so different. You know, it's great to have a change. In September 2008, this is what Boy Bush said, Boy George. The government's top economic experts warned that without immediate action by Congress, America could slip into financial panic and stressful scenario would unfold. More banks could fail, including some in your community. The stock market will drop even more, which would reduce the value of your retirement. Ah! The value of your home can plummet, foreclosure is right dramatically, and your business is finally moving credit. Okay, got the picture, Georgie? Now we have some change. After he comes to power, economists from across the spectrum of war, that if we don't act immediately, millions more jobs will be lost, and national unemployment rates will approach double digits, more people will lose their homes and their healthcare, and our nation will sink into a crisis at some point, we may be unable to reverse. Give them the money! Back! Which is what he did. Trillions that have gone into the ether never to be seen again. Be afraid now that we've invented the monster. I wouldn't have been good at what Obama bring in. He brings in Larry Summers, Rothschild Zionist, who was Treasury Secretary to Clinton and with Greenspan fundamentally was involved in taking the checks and balances away. And he brings in Timothy Geithner, Rothschild Zionist, who was the president of the New York Bank of the Federal Reserve, fundamentally played a part in bringing the crash. And they are now running the economy of America. And then you have also in his economic team, you have this guy, Paul Volcker, former head of the Fed, and you have in the World Bank, Rothschild Zionist, Robert Zoller, and together they are all members of the Bilderberg Group, and they're running the whole show. And if you're going to be run for the people, you have a lot. This is the plan, the same as it did in here. One, crash the global economy, September 2008, let people see there's a problem. Two, get governments, not least by putting your people into government to solve the problem they've created, to throw fantastic amounts of money, credit at the perpetrators until their financial barrels are empty. They want governments to be there in a situation where they have no more means of response because the credit line's over. And then they're going to crash the economy again when the governments have no chance of responding. And then what the idea is that banks, the bankers controlled by the Rothschilds, come forward as the only solution to the problem because governments have no input anymore. And their solution will be a world central bank and a complete centralization of the global financial system. That's the game. And I've been saying this for years too, it's so obvious. They are using America to destroy America. If you want a world government, which is a world dictatorship, the last thing you can have is a superpower with the financial and military might to say no to you. You're not an education if they can do that. So the idea is to destroy America, to bring it under the heel of the world government, and they want to do the same to Russia and China, so that the superpowers come to an end, if you like, and the world government can take control of it. Here we go. I'll do another 20 minutes and then we'll finish this session. Swine flu, like I said earlier, what is the bloody thing? It's a joke. It's created in the laboratory. It's like actually swine flu, it's a combination of swine flu, bird flu, and seasonal flu, it's a concoction. And you know, every now and again, I've quoted one at some length in my new book, which I'm writing at the moment. When you access the timeline, there was a guy called Dr. Richard Day. In 1969, he spoke to a gathering of doctors in Pittsburgh. And he said to them, what Dr. Richard Day was, he was the head of Planned Parenthood, which is a Rockefeller organization, which used to be an openly eugenics organization. Then after Adolf Hitler, and thought, well, we better not be an openly eugenics organization, we'll call ourselves Planned Parenthood. If you follow the story, that's what happened. And it's a Rockefeller eugenics organization. And he was head of it, Dr. Richard Day. And he said to these doctors, I'm going to tell you something, I want you to turn off all recording equipment and not take notes. What he did is good at having notes. One doctor did. He took notes. And he went home, he wrote them up as quick as he could. And he died in 2004. But before that, he did a series of text interviews you get on the internet, in which he described what Richard Day said. And what he said was, 1969, that everything that's happening now, he said it's going to happen. And I teach that in the book, but key to what we're talking about now. He said, we are going to introduce laboratory-created diseases to cull the population. And we're going to cull the population through vaccination. We are going to create a situation where old people are just left to die. This is what all these bloody healthcare changes are about, by the way. It's happening all over the world. Because, well, we can't come back to them with a towel. We should go and all that stuff. Real planet, no, no, of course. But the key thing was he talked about this, that we're going to cull the population to death, massively reduce the population. And that's a thing, a recurring theme. So what's the best way to cull the population is to get access to, so that it's not bloody obvious and everyone keels over. You attack the immune system so they become open to things that they wouldn't normally store. AIDS, people have died of AIDS. They die of age-related diseases, as they're called, which the immune system, which would normally sort out, doesn't. And so the immune system, there's a war on the human immune system. All this shite is in food and drink is the aim of the immune system. And so the idea is like an organic for them. To get access, they want, to virtually every man, woman, and child's body on the planet. That's what they want. And when it doesn't make sense, and there's no logic and no debate or argument to the contrary makes any difference. It's the agenda playing out. And so we have a situation when you follow it where this swine flu, they say, you broke out a pig farm in Mexico in April, but there's no pigs mentioned since. And then people get it, and basically it's 2 or 3 days, you get it back with the same symptoms as flu, and they get up their lives. Fine, okay. But what the World Health Organization and all these, they go, threat to human bloody life! What do you mean? He's back at work. I mean, they start talking about the pandemic. Agenda, red light. And then you start thinking, well, what we were told was that it broke out in Mexico, and then the drug companies, the World Health Organization, started working for a vaccine. Then you find the Vaccine International in Illinois, one of the vaccine makers of this swine flu vaccine, they applied for their patent at least in August 2008, probably new research shows in 2007. They employ a lot of scientists there, see? simply that it's all just happened in a few months. Novartis got their patent through in early 2009, and Baxter got theirs through in March 2009, gone before they released the device. We had the World Health Organization coming. What an appropriate symbol that is, eh? Just a point. What they did, the Rothschilds did, is they're the center of this identity in the five-cents world. They started creating, after the war, a series of organizations with world in them. Because they were trying to get power over various aspects of human life around one table in one building. So you had the World Trade Organization, and it has the power to impose upon countries massive fines if they try to protect their own economies from the merciless world systems. And you have the World Health Organization, which through legislation passed, I think it was 2005, if they announce ever a pandemic at a certain level, they then can dictate to countries, about 200 countries under their umbrella, and tell them how to run their healthcare. Well, they've done that. Hey, it's done back to the basin. And because the Rothschilds and the network control the World Health Organization, the Centers for Disease Control in America, the Food and Drug Administration, and their like in other countries, the American government, the American Medical Association, and the drug companies, they run the whole show. But it's played out in public, and it's all different, they don't. If you control the organizations that are supposed to protect the public, and you control the people you're supposed to protect the public from, the public don't get protected, it's simple. And so we have this swine flu, this swan in it, fundamentally linked to Gulf War syndrome, with mercury in it, and I'm absolutely convinced, I've been saying this for months now, nanotechnology microchips. And, just about a week ago, there's a man in Germany, he's got a German name, he's like, I can't pronounce it, not for the foreigners. But he became famous in Germany because he challenged the medical establishment there and he created a new thing called New German Medicine. And he was doing a talk in Austria very recently. He reported the fact that one member of the audience, the lady who worked in the health industry, stood up and because he started talking about swine flu. And she said that a friend of hers worked for a major pharmaceutical company in Vienna. Now, Baxter International has a major subsidiary called, I think it's Baxter AG in Vienna. They are one of the key vaccines, through the swine flu vaccine makers. And she said that this associate of hers who works for this company said that they were known for nanotechnology microchips, not in the vaccine, but on the end of the needles. And she said, you can't see it with a naked eye, but with a, she said, a 12-level power, which is not much more than a child would use, really. If you look at it through a microscope, you can see it. And the idea is that when they put it in, the microchips go in with them, but it's not in the vaccine, she was saying, it's actually on the tip of the needle. And she said that she herself, the person said, telling the story, worked in the medical profession, and she said she had a patient who was a lawyer. And she asked the lawyer, is there any way of avoiding compulsory vaccination? And he told her, she said, that the elite of society had long known that this was coming, and they were going to put microchips in with the vaccine. But the elite and certain chosen politicians were going to avoid it. But everyone else, no chance. Oh, what will bloody see about that one? What will bloody see about that one? But with all these different strands coming together, and because there's been so fantastic work on the internet to get this stuff out, they're going to have a big shock about how many people are going to say no to this around the world. The opinion poll in Britain, 50% of pretty doctors are in like it. When they start putting the pressure on, like increasing the strength of the vaccine over the virus, like all this other stuff. And when they start to say, oh, everyone's got to be vaccinated because we need herd immunity, which takes those who've been vaccinated against those who've not been vaccinated to start that business. My question, you've been vaccinated, what's your problem? What's your problem? You're all right, yeah? the people who get the vaccination, there are people saying, oh, you have been vaccinated, you're in danger to my children. No, darling, your children are in danger to mine. Because live vaccine goes in, and A, that can give you the virus, live virus rather, goes into the vaccine, that can give you the virus. They withdrew oral polio in America, as I was reading the other day, because it was giving people polio, or a form of it. And the other thing is, through something called shedding through the faces, through the mucous membranes, through the urine, someone vaccinated with live virus can pass it on to others. Mm-hmm. And just think, 25 is it now vaccinations for young kids, babies under the age of 2, where their immune system is still forming. The idea is to totally destroy its full efficiency for the rest of their lives. That's what it's about. And so the greatest thing we can do for our children at the time, no bloody vaccination, and ourselves by the way, is that our compliance standards. It's like I was saying earlier, you know, when Britain declared war on Germany in 1939 after Germany invaded Poland, nothing happened for 8 months that you could see. It became known in Britain as the phony war. We declared war, but nothing happened, and then it broke out, all the rest of it. Well, we're now coming to the end of the phony war, but what I mean by that is, over the years now, we've been communicating and exposing this agenda, but not actually engaging with it. But exposing it as if it was going on. It was going along here, we were going along there. We've come to the point where the irresistible force that thinks it is but isn't the agenda, or the irresistible force, human awakening rather, is coming face to face with the immovable object that thinks it is, but it's the agenda. And we're going to start looking it in the eye, and this swipe goes, it goes on, look at it immediately, as this goes on, this is the point where we start looking this agenda in the eye. And that's good, because we're at a point where well, we can bring this to an end. And this is very true. This is very symbolic of what's happening. Well, we've lost our jobs, and our houses are more closed, but at least it can't get any worse. This is something that we need to prepare for, because they are about to throw, as we say in England, everything above the kitchen sink. Well, including the kitchen sink and including the plot, in the next few months and years, to bring about so much chaos that we will say, there is everything, and they will bring order out of chaos, and will be their control system. So we really do need to be aware of this and become conscious, realizing this is an experience, not us, it's crucial. Very quickly, I'm going to go through some headlines. On the basis of everything that we've talked about so far, connecting the dots, globalization, centralization of global power, people go, globalization, all that stuff, what is it? It's the centralization agenda playing out. And what these people that protest against globalization but reject the wider conspiracy need to do is start to realize that this is not, globalization is not about greedy corporations. Greedy corporations are the vehicle to play it out. The real origin of globalization is way beyond the corporations, and it plays out through them. They're vehicles. And globalization protesters are focusing on the vehicle and not the origin. Free trade, that is to make sure that no one can defend their own economy, and that you can make something for a few cents here, poverty wages, bring it here and sell it for a big profit. And free trade is to make sure everything is dependent on everything else, so there's no freedom of movement except within the control system. The war on terror is about frightening people to bring about this. Again, when you control all these different organizations and countries, you can run a terror campaign that seems to most people to be the true story being true. It's actually a control system. Playing it out. An evil existence threatens every man and woman and child in this great nation. We must take steps to ensure our domestic security and protect our homeland. Adolf Hitler just inclined to start off. If it works, why change it? And so we're having this now, this Orwellian global state, and this is not to control the people. No. This is to control the people who are aware what's going on. They're not interested in controlling Bill and Joe, who are recent salvation in Mark 3, they are aware that there's a big wake-up happening, and people are starting to see it. This control system is for the people who are awakening and can see it, not for those who can't. There's no problem whatsoever. That's what this is for. This is why we're seeing the militarization of the police to bring in this control system, is to keep the people in line who have seen it, who have sussed it. This is why we've got tasers, 55,000 volts, which, you know, there's some very intelligent police officers, but there's some freaking morons. There's a lot of them. Because then you know anything you say, officer. It's what the sound equipment is about. Because they know that it's coming. The awakening is like it's coming and people are seeing it. And indeed, as they bring it more and more into society, more and more people are going to see it because it's going to be obvious. This is what the control system is for. The microchips are, yes, about electronic tagging, but they're all about also external manipulation of our emotions and our physical state and our mental state, our thoughts. I was told this by a CIA scientist in 1997, who incidentally told me in 1997, you know, microchips are now so small, he said, that they can insert them in hypodermic needles in vaccination programs. He said, that's what they intend to do. 1997 he told me that. The microchip is for external control. We talked about earlier about a brain-computer interface. That's what the microchip's for. To access the computer and manipulate it from afar. That's what this is about. This stuff is about the chemical destabilization of the body so that it does not function as a fully fledged, sharp receiver transmitter of information. That's what it's for. It's not genetically modified food, which is designed to genetically modify us. It's about keeping us in a vibrational prison. But consciousness can overcome it. Consciousness can overcome everything. This is the so important global warming. Sorry, climate change. It's to bring in massive taxation, and it's being passed now. It has been passed. People are going to your bloody home without your permission, with fines if you don't let them in, to check your carbon footprint, when this guy's carbon footprint is the size of Godzilla. Thanks for the Oscars, but I'm totally full of crap. And we know they have those live Earth concerts, you know, with Donald's on the stage. You know, it's a scam, he's singing about it. You know, it seems to be all around the world. Anyway, they have a global warming survival handbook to go with these live Earth concerts, written by David de Rothschild, who's an environmentalist. Oh, yeah, okay. He was the one who went on the Alex Jones show, and Alex said, why are other moons of other planets warming? Why is Mars warming? And the brilliant de Rothschild said, because Alex, Mars is closer to the sun. you don't get a good education with de Rothschild, you get a good indoctrination. Now, here we go. Is a breakdown of greenhouse gases. This is water vapor. 90-odd% of greenhouse gases are water vapor. I say we ban it. Ban water vapor. We are going to have a ban on condensation. Clouds. Seafood. This is carbon dioxide, and the green bit is the part of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere that comes from human activity. Unbelievably cold. And in this network, the Club of Rome, created in 1968, used the environment to justify global change. And this is from the creator of the Club of Rome, big friend of his, Aurelio Pecci. He wrote in the Colorado document, First Global Revolution, 1991, in searching for a new enemy to unite us, we came up with an idea that pollution, the threat of global warming, water shortage, expanding and the like, would fit the bill. And so it's played out. But very quickly, this is a guy in England. He's an environmental scientist who's worked with Greenpeace. This is no guy representing oil companies. Not that that matters, because they're part of it as well. I was more than a quarter of our companies. Governor Peter Taylor, lovely guy, I saw his presentation. This is what he says. Behind the scenes, there is a major disagreement among scientists. Tens of thousands of scientists have signed documents saying global warming is not provable or is rubbish. Parallel to carbon dioxide rising, the solar field has increased by over 200% since 1990, and this is not factored into the computer models. Computer models, shite in, shite out. Simple as that. You put certain things, assumptions in, you're going to get this out. Oh, look, we're dying. I don't know about you. I came through Bernie Phoenix the other day on the way here. I walked off the plane, I thought the airport was on fire. Anyway, you know when that kind of bored yellow stuff comes out and the cloud moves? To give back, it's got warmer. I've got this gun. I know that's in our way, I get it far, I guess it's inside. I think that's got something to do with the temperature of the planet itself. And I think when there's more solar radiation on the cycle, there's warmer, when there's less, like there is now, it goes down. I think I've ruled that out. Our core's got a problem though. He ain't worked it out. Of course he has, this is the bloody line. Global temperature is not rising as predicted. In fact, it fell more than 0.6 degrees in the last 12 months, as much as it had gained in the previous 50 years. Many of the apparently random fluctuations in past temperature, like when the Vikings grew crops in Greenland, correlate with variations of the solar electric field. Between 1983 and 2001, cloud cover, according to the International Satellite Cloud Climatology Project, fell by 4%, more than enough to keep oceans in the account of global warming. A spate of recent science shows that temperature oscillations are timed by solar cycles, that the jet stream effect is affected by the solar winds, and that past high and low points of the solar cycle correlate with past temperature swings. It's the sun. In the new world order. And This is what they're. I feel so sorry for these young people because they're being mercilessly targeted on every angle because they're the ones that will be the adults in the playing out period that they want. What the good news is, by the time young kids become not too long ago, young kids, a few years from now, these buggers are out of it. And so. This explosion of drugs being given to children, while they're inventing things like attention deficit disorder to justify giving them more. And it's what they call it, that Arnold Huxley talked about in Brave New World, the drugging of people, the drugging of kids so they love their servitude. I mean, it's staggering. I saw a film the other day, the number of antidepressants taken by American people every year is extraordinary, apart from being fed up and filled. No! Stop being fed up in another way, you don't appeal. I mean, I suffered from attention deficit disorder when I was at school, that poor guy did. Political correctness. This is not about protecting minorities, just like the hate laws. It's about reducing our ability to express ourselves through fear of upsetting anybody. Oh, you've upset me. Well, political correctness upsets me, man, that bugger there. But, you know, Orwell said about words that we think in words on the level of thought. And as you reduce the number of words, not only reduce the ability to articulate the detail of your thoughts, you actually, as generations pass, you lose the ability to even think in detail because you don't have the words to think in detail with. And he talked about old speak, diversity of language being replaced by new speak. No diversity in language, and we see it. And texting, by the way, is part of it. You are this and all that stuff, so that's all part of it as well. And all this political correctness, which is stopping you expressing yourself in detail. Oh, this is a political correct sign, by the way. Of course, this sign is sharp edges. Do not touch any of this sign. Of course, though, the British out here. The number of times we are told what to do or not to do, where to go, not to do this, stop this, do that, take that, all this stuff, is creating a situation. They know what they're doing. When they do behavior tests and trials and experiments in laboratories with mice and stuff, they'll literally amaze. And they will put electric triggers down some of the channels in the maze. So when the mouse goes and gets an electric shock, and it goes down another one. And if it goes back there, it's another electric shock, well, it's thinking, I ain't going there again. And so it goes on. And what they do eventually is they take the electric shock away, and the mouse still won't go down there. And because it's had enough punishments, enough shocks, that its actual behavior has been rewired. Its perception has been rewired, and it's been brought into docility to follow the system that the control has forced it into. That's what it's all about. They are bombarding us with so much legislation, so many laws, so many do's, don'ts, and musts. The idea is that we acquiesce by taking the least line of resistance until eventually we just become subordinate, robotic, mindless followers of the system. And we will do that if we get caught in mind. If we get caught in consciousness, or we're not caught in consciousness, we open to consciousness, then that system of programming acquiescence will not have a bloody chance. And so that's why it's so important to become conscious, because when you're here and you see this as an experience, they can try to program the experience, but that's not where the perception's coming from. It's coming from a point where it's beyond their vibrational realms we can access, never mind, program. I mean, what service is that? That's the idea. We stay in mind, that's their opportunity to do that. And people say, well, we never do that. People have already done that. This is China today, waiting to start working a factory. People do acquiesce to this level, and that's what they want. And China is their blueprint for the global society. The rabbit hole goes very, very deep, but it's all about perception. The perception that I have no power. Solve that, as we'll see in the final section. I'll be back in half an hour. Thank you very much.